Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, this is Virginia. Events over recent years have highlighted racial inequalities across the globe, and Australia is not an exception. Here at Broad Talk, we recognise that the path towards true reconciliation is the responsibility of all of us, all the time. In that spirit, we acknowledge the traditional owners of the country on which we record this podcast, the Ngunnawal and Ngambri people, and pay our respects to the elders past, present, and emerging.
The system is broken.
I don't get the rules at all.
How far can we work within a system that we need to get rid of?
I think men feel somehow women's liberation is a threat to their manhood.
And it is.
Tragically, I couldn't give a shit whether you think I have a right to speak up about anything or not.
People who make revolutions get burnt.
We started it here!
Maybe, you know, I've got some sort of crazy speak up about it mental illness.
Change takes time. Do you have any regrets?
No.
No matter how often I hear that opening sting with all its angry power, it still makes me smile, and I hope it does you too. Hello, and I'm Virginia Hausker. It's so lovely to have your company for this very special series that we're bringing you in partnership with MOAD, the Museum of Australian Democracy, housed in Canberra's old Parliament House, where I've had the wonderful honour of guest curating a new exhibition on Australian women changemakers. And in this series, we dive into the personal stories and professional stories of some of those outstanding women. We poke around a little bit about what it means to be a changemaker and how they got to where they did. We talk about the challenges and the costs. So stick with us for the series as you're in for a feast of raw and very real and inspiring stories. And you can find us on all the usual places on social media, on Insta for Broad Talk at Broad Talkers. Check out our Facebook, Broad Talk, or mine, Virginia Hausker. You can find me on Twitter, Virginia House. And, of course, drop into our broadtalk.net website. If you subscribe there, you'll get a little newsletter from us every now and then, and you'll find all the episodes, not just of this series, but all the preceding series as well. So today we're joined by someone I'm really looking forward to talking to, someone I've only met very briefly, Sally McManus. Sally is, of course, the Secretary of the ACTU. We only met very briefly on the day of the March for Justice rally held in 2021 here in Canberra. And Sally, along with Michelle, the president of the ACTU, were speakers along with myself. So it was a brief meeting, but what an exciting day that was. But what I want to say is Sally's bio actually doesn't tell us much about her. Her official bio says that she is the 10th secretary of the ACTU, but it doesn't mention the fact that she's in fact the first female secretary. It also tells us that she was leader of the ASU, the Australian Services Union, New South Wales, and that she started as a trainee organiser in 1994. It tells us that she's worked as a pizza delivery driver, a cleaner, and a shop assistant, and that she studied philosophy. We also know that Sally is a bird watcher, a photographer, and a black belt in Kung Fu. Sally, welcome to Broad Talk. It's fantastic to have you here.
G'day, Virginia. It's also good to be here.
Look, I'm going to ask you, with that bio in mind, other than the fact that you're 51, what does...
I'm 50. I'm not 51. Oh.
I'm sorry, I've already stuffed it up.
I suppose I'm nearly 51. Yeah, I'll take it.
Okay, got my counting wrong. Sorry about that. But look, other than your age, what is it about you that your official bio doesn't tell us that is something that you can share, something important about your identity?
That's a hard question. I'm a vegetarian. I guess that's the only other thing I can say that's like a day-to-day thing that it would be anything other than, I guess these days people see on social media and people see you on the media and, you know, people, because social media has been around for a while, like really with me is what you see is what you get. Like there's you know, nothing else. Oh, I like sport a lot, but, yeah, I don't think there's anything else that's too big or exciting that isn't already seen publicly.
You're a runner. I just learned that this morning too. You're also clearly a very, very hard worker who puts in long days, long hours, and is someone who's clearly dedicated to your job. Do you do much outside your work?
To be honest, no, not really. Like the bird watching or being in nature is like the one thing that's the thing that I do to clear my mind and that isn't to do with work. And also, obviously, you know, exercise. Exercise, in a way, is part of like keeping fit, but it's also a mental health thing. Like I found that regular running and not all my life, but since I was probably 19, I've done martial arts. But those things are part of, I guess, keeping fit, but also maintaining discipline as well. So. Yeah, I do work long hours in a high-pressure environment, so it is important to have like some outlets. I definitely find that that's essential in my job.
Sally, you are the first person I've met who is a bird watcher, and I don't want to spend too much time on this, but I'm just fascinated. What is that about? I mean, it just seems so incongruous for someone who, you know, I don't know, lives a really busy life and is a fast mover, to be a bird watcher. I mean, I know you've travelled the world photographing birds and bird watching. What's that about?
Look, it didn't start like I was a bird watcher. I wasn't one of those people who had a bird book when I was a kid and looked it up or anything like that. And for a while I even resisted the title bird watcher, and some people try and call you a twitcher and things like that. I started off very close friends since I was a teenager, and he is like, he could name every single one, and he and I would go on, you know, trips all the time, and he'd be all the time talking about the birds. And I bought a camera, and it was through the lens of the camera that I became a bird watcher. And for me, it's about the excitement of going out, not knowing what you're going to find, having a target. Like, so if you're going somewhere and you're looking for something that's really rare, and you might spend like all day walking, looking, waiting, trying to find this rare bird. And I suppose if we had things like leopards and tigers, I'd be doing it with leopards and tigers. But it's exciting when you find them, and it's exciting when you find like anything that's a bit different, and then the skill of being able to actually take the photos. There's one thing to see the bird, but it's almost like, did it really happen if you didn't take a photo?
Yeah,
so I enjoy the photography side of it, and through photography I think I became a bird watcher.
It's fascinating. Lions, I get that. I think that would be exciting. Birds, I'm not so sure. But look, I find it fascinating that you do that. I want to ask you this though. You just mentioned that, you know, what you see is what you get with you. Let's go to when you first took up the role as secretary of the ACTU, which, as I said, you're first woman to do that. And I want to bring you back to that famous now early interview you did, TV interview on the ABC. I think it was with Lee Sales, where you said something that was pretty, well, got you in a lot of trouble. You refuse to condemn illegal industrial action when you're asked about, do you believe in the rule of law? And I'm just going to quote what you said. You said, look, I believe in the rule of law when the law is fair and the law is right, but when it's unjust, I don't think there's a problem with breaking it. Now, that led to, I must admit, I was listening live at the time and thought, great, okay, I had a really good sense of who you were then, and that made sense to me. But it smashed open the media headlines, suggesting that you were basically inciting unionists to be lawbreakers. Indeed, federal minister said you were a lunatic. In retrospect, was that a mistake? Were you being just too blatantly Sally McManus there and not careful enough?
I don't regret it one little bit. I told the truth. I said something that I believe in, something that I live by, something that a whole lot of people that have been about challenging the powerful and have brought about change have always believed in, because we've had to. Like when laws have been unfair and unjust and they've been designed to oppress people have had to challenge them. And the fact that in our country, we basically criminalise industrial action, like the right to strike, whereas most other countries in the world, and some of them have got in their constitution as like a fundamental right. It's a fundamental right recognised internationally that has to be protected, yet we don't do that in Australia. So I don't regret it one little bit. I would say the same tomorrow. I did not expect, though, like I had no idea whatsoever the reaction that it was going to get. Lots of people have said to me, oh, well, that was an interesting media strategy. I can see why you did it, et cetera, et cetera. And there was no media strategy to it. I just dealt with a question that was bowled up to me and answered it in a straight way. And it did lead to a week of front page screaming headlines from, you know, the Murdoch press and other parts of the press, but mainly the Murdoch press. You then sent, you know, camera, you know, paparazzi, but, you know, people to take photos of me outside, you know, in the ACTU office and follow me around, and then to sort of like go through every bit of social media so that they could try and confect some story that I was some sort of, you know, radical monster. And this went on for a week. It was like a complete storm. So I wasn't expecting that. And, you know, then when it happened, it was so full on. And I guess a really wise person said to me, when you're in the middle of a storm, stand still. And I wish I didn't exactly know that at the time, but looking back, that's the advice I'd actually give to people if they're in that situation.
What do you mean by that? How would standing still have changed things for you?
Well, I did end up staying fairly still anyway, but that wasn't like a conscious sort of, okay, you know, situation. It would just be, you know, what have I learnt out of that? What it actually taught me was not to be afraid of the media. And I'm really glad that I had that lesson on the very first day of being ACTU secretary, because effectively, like the forces, you know, that wanted to throw everything they could, including the government, like being told to resign on day one.
I've got to say, that was pretty dramatic, I've got to say. That's a first as well.
By prime ministers, by, of course, all the employer organisations. I think in a way they were hoping that they could put me back in my box and you know, have you, you know, retreat, and that would, you know, exactly what they wanted. But I just had no intention of doing any of that.
Sally, I'm just curious as to know, you know, did it worry you though? I mean, did you, particularly when the federal minister called you a lunatic, did you feel like, okay, I'm going to have to do some repairing here? Because you do have to work with government and you have to work with employers. You have to work with people who obviously didn't like what you did, what you said.
It didn't worry me at all that Peter Dutton called me a lunatic. In fact, it was like just one of the swirling insults that was being thrown at the time. I didn't even hear it until a few days afterwards. And I thought, well, all these people, I saw them doing this for a purpose and to get me to back down. I wasn't going to back down. And in a way, it was a test. And so it was about whether or not I could get through it, really. And I had a press club speech booked for 2 weeks after, I think, this. There was a bit of a discussion about whether it should be cancelled or whether it should be, you know, put off. And I just said, look, there's no way that I'm going to be the leader of the trade union movement and hide. You know, no. Like, even though that's going to continue to be, you know, a big drama, I am going to do that press club speech. And that day of the press club speech was the same. It was like the media all over you. And in the end, after that, I got up and I explained what I said and why and what I believed in. And it was sort of like, okay, well, you've been through all of that. And I think in a way I sort of normalized, you know, some of those, you know, the thing that I said, you know, went from, oh, it's the worst thing in the world, to people going, oh, yeah, actually, really, is it that bad? And, yeah, so I just think that the good thing is that I didn't worry every day, like, what the media was going to say, because I thought, well, they've done their worst.
I want to ask you about style, though, because I think following that, an important stakeholder for you, the head of the BCA, said you were different from other union leaders and suggested that that you opt for conflict and campaign building rather than problem solving and collaboration. Was that a fair call?
Well, Jennifer and I, she's the head of the BCA, actually get on today. So I think that this was them not understanding me and understanding where we were coming from. I was just being honest and direct. That's what I was doing. And I'm sure that a whole lot of business leaders would love, you know, tame trade union leaders, and they certainly weren't going to get that from me. But to think that it's sort of like a deliberate strategy is wrong. Like, I deal with the situation in front of us, and at the moment in Australia, you know, working people have the lowest share of the nation's wealth that we've had since the 1960s. Like, inequality is a massive problem. Wage growth is a massive problem. And big business has never been more powerful. So I'm just echoing the truth of what's going on. And, you know, I continue to do that, like, with Jennifer. But I would say that, not speaking on her behalf, but she would respect that I'm saying where we're coming from and not doing this as a strategy, and also listen to the point of view of others too. So I think that was an unsophisticated view of me at the time.
You've mentioned fairness. In fact, you wrote a small book on fairness for the Melbourne Uni Press as one of their small book series. What is fairness as far as you're concerned? Is fairness innate? Is it something that's driven by our personal moral compass, or do we need rules around fairness? Just to add to that, if we do need rules, who gets to make them? Whose values are they based on?
So going to the first part, I mean, fairness does start from a view that as humans we're all equal, like we're all equal in terms of we're all born equally human, and that we all should get a fair go and be treated fairly, and the goal of equality is one that's worthy because of that. Because if you believe that we're all equal, to have situations where some people have a lot or some people are discriminated against and others aren't is fundamentally unfair. And do you need rules? Well, of course you do, because within this situation, some people have power and some people don't. And where people abuse that power, they discriminate against people or they create societies that are fundamentally unequal. It's a job of governments who are meant to represent everyone to take action to redress that power imbalance. So in the case of workers' rights, that's what workers' rights are all about. Like, if you had no workers' rights, of course, it would be the rule of the jungle and, you know, the strong would always win, and in the end you'd have a terrible society. So that's why it's important to, if you believe in fairness and believe in inequality, to have, you know, structures that support that.
When it comes to gender equality, and I ask you this again as the first female in the role as Secretary of the ACTU, is gender equality about fairness? Is that perhaps the prime selling point for you?
Well, of course it's about fairness. It's about, you know, the equality of all humans. So, how does that fit with women having been paid less, having less opportunities, retiring with less money, not being considered equally for jobs, all of those things. It's you know, fairness is just a shorthand way of talking about a whole lot of other fancy terms.
But the other aspects that are brought into this argument around gender equality, particularly in terms of democratic representation, just the inability to for societies to function well if women don't play a significant and equal part in public life, is that part of the discussion too, as far as you're concerned, or is it primarily just about fairness?
Well, it's a flow on. Like, if the principle is fairness, a flow on is that women should be equally represented, fairly represented in this case, because we're 51% equally represented in decision making bodies, and the basic idea that, you know, our decision making bodies should reflect the people that they're making decisions about, it is something that we should absolutely insist on, not just aspire to, insist on.
It's fascinating to learn that the average union member now is female, and I believe in her early 40s. Does that mean that men are turning away from unions?
Well, it's more to do with the structure of the workforce. Like, there's the highest participation of women in the workforce than we've ever had in the paid workforce in Western society. So that's a fact. Secondly, our biggest union is the teachers' union, the nurses' union, the nurses' union. So they became our biggest union only about 5 years ago, and followed by the teachers' union. And there's been a big change in the structure of our economy. And Australia has a very gender segregated workforce.
Terribly. And also, of course, those sectors where women dominate are the lowest paid.
Yeah, so it's not so much that men are turning away, it's just that women have not just taken up, they've overtaken. And it's because those big professions, nursing and teaching, are the dominant unions now within the trade union movement.
Okay, I want to talk to you a little bit more about gender equality within the movement itself, the trade union movement, but we're going to take a short break and back in just a moment.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Welcome back. Sally McManus, gender equality within the ACTU. It hasn't always been a hallmark of trade unions, gender equality. Early on in your own career, I know that you have spoken before about being easily dismissed as a young woman. I think you were still in your teens, actually, when you had a leadership role. And in fact, have spoken about how you were referred to as just a fucking girl. Did you manage that within the union movement? Did you return sexism with sexism, or did you play it like the boys? What did you do?
Oh, well, I mean, it's hard talking about like back in the day when you were very young, and certainly I didn't have the confidence just to return sexism with sexism back then, or even to sort of stand up and, you know, to say to, you know, these people, these men that were more powerful to you directly, all the things that I would do now, you know. So, you know, that was definitely the case. And the other thing is that, you know, in a way it was a shock to be in some unions, the union I was in at that time as a young union organizer, and to only have, you know, men around me. But then after a while you sort of got used to it. Well, I just learned something really important. And at that time too, I mean, I was a feminist, and there was, in the union movement, there has been for 100 years, and there continues to be a very active feminist discussion that happens all the time. So within unions, but across unions. So there's, you know, union women have led like most of the progressive women's movement in Australia the whole time we've had that movement. So unlike other workplaces and other organisations, I've had the privilege of being part of that. So can the thing I – yeah.
Sorry, but can I just ask you, I find that sort of at times I don't know, there's a sort of a contradiction there, because we also know that at times the union movement has harboured some real – shocking sexist, actually, and some sexism, and we've seen cases of that just in the last couple of years, with a well, you know, very high profile case of a Victorian union leader who's still in the movement and still in a leadership role. So how do you reconcile that, though, that there is that what some would believe is an inherent sexism within the trade union movement?
Well, I would say that that's no more than anywhere else, except that the fight back about that's been more intense. So you think about it, the first woman leader of the ACTU was Jenny George, and that's 30 years ago. Like, that's a long time ago. Then very, very strong feminists. Then you had Sharon Burrow, who's now the head of the whole World Trade Union movement. Australia has produced that, and is a strong feminist. They had Jed Carney, and now you've got two women leaders of the ACTU, myself and Michelle, both strong feminists. But below us, there's a whole like raft of leadership there. And it's not to say that, like, you know, we're the largest, you know, fee-paying movement in the country by far, like by far, and we reflect the whole of society. So it's inevitable that there will be people that are sexist or racist or a whole lot of things, because it's a reflection of the overall society. But the difference is that there's a constant discussion about this, and that there's 50% women on the ACTU executive, and we've had that way before they've had it in Parliament, way before any corporate, any business, any big business that's got that. So I would say that, yes, we have these issues. The difference is that we are ahead, I think, of the curve, not behind the curve, and we're ahead of the curve because there's like an active feminist consciousness within the trade union movement.
If there's been such strong feminism within the movement, and look, I certainly accept what you say, nevertheless, why is it, though, that those feminist-dominated industries remain the lowest paid? I mean, I know you've been very, very active, particularly in the community sector, in getting pay rises. But, you know, let's face it, it's women still, and we've been talking about this for decades, or certainly all the time I've been a journalist for the last 30 years, about these pathetically low-paid industries being dominated by women. And despite that feminism within the ACTU, you haven't been able to nudge those wages anywhere near where they should be.
Well, it's also got a lot to do with the structure of those jobs. So if you think about we talked before about our workplace has been very gender, our profession has been very gender segregated in Australia. So the ones that are dominated by men are in industries that are for-profit industries, where if they take strike action, business immediately feels the power of that. And there's a different bargaining power that comes when that happens, as opposed to if you are a community services worker and you work in the homeless services, if you stop work, who suffers? Well, it's the, you know, people in homeless who are homeless, and that those who are in need. So, and do really, you know, big business care about that? Probably not, right? So you would have to stop work for a very long time to achieve the same outcomes you'd have if you're in, let's say you worked on the wharves. So you've got to recognise that to start off with. Same with nurses and same with teachers. It's not grinding the economy to a halt by using some of those options that working people have got. So I don't think it's fair to say to those workers, those women in those industries, that you've got to recognise, first of all, that they don't have the same structural power. So they then need to organise in different ways, as they are. So at the moment, you can see huge strike waves of aged care workers, of teachers, of nurses. And you look at the faces of those workers that are taking that action, they're all young women and migrant young women. It's really fantastic to see. And I look at those faces and I just know that's the future of the trade union movement.
Sally, on power, let's just talk a little bit about that. And this is going to sound like an odd question, but where is power located in you? Obviously, you've got a lot of power. Is it as a result of your role as head of the ACTU? Or do you feel like you have an innate power anyway?
My power comes from how well organised unions are. So not from me, but from workers. And so me sitting in this, me as an individual have no power. Me sitting in this chair as ACTU's secretary has some power, but not much more. The extent of power that I may or may not have depends on how organised, you know, union members are towards a common goal that we're pushing. So if I'm pushing for something and I'm doing that by myself, that's not going to get us anywhere. It's only been where you can marshal the forces of the whole trade union movement behind something and we're all pushing one direction. That's where that power comes from.
How personally do you feel responsible for restoring faith and membership and power to the union movement? Because we know that in fact unions are, or the union movement is much, much smaller now than it was certainly when I first started as a journalist, and it was in the 80s. Unions were very, very powerful, in fact huge, and constant media stories were being done about union action. Not so now at all. And in fact, the number of Australian workers who are members of unions is probably at the lowest it's ever been. So is this something very personal for you?
I take 100% responsibility, like full, total responsibility for what you talked about unions growing, but also the reputation of the union movement. So that doesn't mean that, and that's a hard thing because I can't control everything. So, but nevertheless, I take 100% responsibility, but I take a long view. So it's not that within the time that I sit in the chair I've got now that I can turn around what has been decades and decades of union decline for a whole lot of reasons beyond our control. It's that by the time I leave this chair, I have to have built the platform for whoever takes over afterwards to have that happen. So I need to leave the union movement in a better position than when I left and with the platform to grow.
When you first became ACTU secretary and being the first woman, Jed Carney said a really interesting thing about you. She told a journalist that she said, you haven't changed to meet the times. She's known you for a long time and that you haven't changed to meet the times, but the times have caught up with Sally. And she went on to say, Sally's just perfectly in the right place at the right time, not only nationally but globally. What was she saying about you? What did you take that to mean?
I think that might go back to what the BCA leader said at the time too, that I was different to the other leaders. I mean, I think it is just that because I was saying directly what we believed, and I'll continue to say directly the truth of the situation in a time where of growing inequality and where our workers have less power and less rights than they ever have, which we just talked about just not being afraid of saying that and not being afraid of saying upsetting people. Not because you're going out to upset people or you're going out to create conflict. It's just, you know, that when sometimes you tell the truth, it does upset people, as we've seen. I think that's what Jed was talking about. And she's right. Like, I haven't changed. I've not tried to. The only thing I've changed since being ACTU secretary is wearing makeup more often.
I must admit, on your very first interview, I noticed you did have a bit of makeup on. I thought, oh, that's unusual.
Well, it's
unusual for a secretary of the ACTU. How do you ignore the criticism, though? I mean, there has been criticism, and I don't mean just criticism of how you're doing your job, but, I mean, really sexist, awful stuff, online in particular. How do you manage that? Do you just develop do you naturally have a steely spine?
Well, you can't be like a union representative, you know, for as long as I have, which I don't know how long now, like 28 years, and then not be tough. And it wasn't that I was some tough person when I started. It's just that you learn it because, like, you're constantly in situations that where you're representing and standing with workers that are in battles, and you don't win all of those. In fact, you probably lose way more than you win. And so you're used to, like, being the underdog, like, all the time you are, and all the time you've got to just deal with that situation of conflict. And people will, especially when you're taking on people who have a lot to lose, they'll throw whatever they've got at you. So I guess by the time I became ACTU secretary and social media came around and people are throwing, you know, what they do at you, like lots of sexism, you know, lots of, you know, terrible comments, is that I just don't care. Like, I honestly do not care. And I could not care less what those anonymous people say, because it doesn't matter to me. What matters to me is what union members think, and what, you know, I always imagine the people behind me, like the faces of the people behind me, and I know they support me, and that's what matters. The other thing is I just have like a really strong thing about, it's like you've got a certain amount of energy in your day and in your life. And if I'm giving any of that energy, any of your life force to being upset or paying attention to some horrible sexist troll on Twitter, well, they're eking away at that energy, and I want all of it to go towards what we're trying to achieve for working people, and none of it to go to them.
What makes you second guess yourself, or when do you doubt yourself? I would think that most of us doubt ourselves at some time, even great change makers and movement builders.
I think there's moments, like, you know, often that you do, that you think, you know, not so much yourself, although sometimes you do that too, but am I pursuing things in the right way? Like, is my strategy right? Perhaps I'm going down this track too far. And because we are such a collective movement, there's this constant sort of discussions happening, like within the leadership of unions around what to do. So I sort of feel as though, well, I know, and it's just so normal and natural that you've got this, okay, whenever you get to a point where you're not sure or you're doubting, I basically will spend half the day on the phone talking to people. And out of like the collective decision, then we decide to go forward. So at times where I sort of get to that point, that's what I do. If it's an issue of personal doubt, again, I think I go to people that I trust, like people that I think that will tell me the truth and not, you know, tell you what they think you want to hear. And I have to say, most of the people close to me do just tell you directly. And that usually they slap me out of it.
I like that. They slap you out of it.
Not literally, obviously.
No, I know what you mean. I want to ask you about how creative you think, or how creative you have to be sometimes in finding solutions to things. But I just want to preface this by a little story, if you don't mind, because it's a favourite story of mine. When I first started work as a journalist, the biggest rallies I ever went to, and in fact still the biggest rallies in my life, have been union rallies in Melbourne in the 1980s. BLF was huge, the Builders Labourers Federation. Norm Gallagher was the head of that. And at one stage, my school, my old school, which was a Catholic, run by Catholic nuns, a girls' school, was having some building done. And the union went on strike, and that building sat untouched for a long, long time, for months. I think it was the new science block. And the nun who ran my school, who was all of 4 foot tall, got in the car with two of the other nuns, drove down to Trades Hall to meet with Norm Gallagher, asked to meet with him. No, she didn't have an appointment, but she'd like to meet with Mr. Gallagher. He sat down with her. They had a cup of tea. She explained that this hold-up of the building was just not acceptable anymore, and the girls needed this science block. And he finished off the meeting, so the legend goes, saying, "Don't you worry, Sister Pat. I'll get the boys onto it." The very next day, truckloads of workers turned up, and that science block got built. Now, that was a beautiful solution to a big problem, but a kind of creative one too. Does that kind of thing still happen?
Well, I think that it shows that Norm Gallagher was more scared of your nuns than he was of, you know, the most powerful capitalist in Australia at that time.
Well, she was very formidable, I got to say, but she was gorgeous. But honestly, she was so tiny, but boy, oh boy, she knew her football, and she knew her way around.
She sounds like an awesome union rep. Like, she sounds like you definitely want to have her represent you. I think that just shows too about how there's more of a connection to the community, and you know, you think about the green band movements, a whole lot of things that in the end, you know, the nun and that school and those builders, like, are all the same people, really. That wasn't your question, though. What was your question?
Oh, the question was about being creative solutions.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, you work within, we've talked about rules and the fairness and the rules around fairness, et cetera. Do you find sometimes you have to really be very creative?
Yeah, especially, like, you know, you always find yourself, you've got to change people who don't want to change. So, and you're usually in the situation where you don't have as much power as them, not always, but usually. And so you've got to use everything you can, but not only that, you've got to shake things up. So disrupting, you know, the way that they would expect you to fight. So, for example, when I was leading the ASU, we were organising community workers and they were fighting for equal pay. And the employer organisation, you know, was just saying no to everything. And we organised a rally of domestic violence workers were the main sort of group leading this onto their offices to deliver to them, you know, a request to reconsider. They called the riot police, like the riot police to, you know, these women, domestic violence workers, and they were so outraged. And so what we all did instead was bring flowers and presents, and then we presented them to the riot police and then to the employers to ask them to reconsider, and it really sort of disrupted that. Some of the really fantastic things, I think, too, and it's becoming a bit of a tradition in our country, I think, if you look at the recent strikes that are happening with teachers and with nurses, read the signs that they've made and they've done. It's sort of taking the internet memes to on the ground action, and some of those are so creative.
Fantastic.
But also you've got to think about what is actually going to move your decision makers. So creative things are great, and if they expect you to do something the same way all the time, they're going to be prepared for it. But if you do something different, they're not going to be. But it's got to be something that's effective.
Sally, I've asked you previously about role models, and you've mentioned Sharon Burrow, and you, as you pointed out, she's now a hugely powerful and significant union leader globally, and not bad for a woman who was formerly a country teacher, I think. You've also mentioned Jenny George, both those women previously presidents of the ACTU, and you spoke of Margaret Jones. Now, Margaret is not someone I knew. Tell us about Margaret.
Well, Margaret was one of my best mates. Unfortunately, she's passed away, and she was 95 when she did, and we were friends, very good friends, for probably 30 years. You know, went away on holidays together. I would spend the time that I was ACTU secretary flying up from Sydney all the time to spend time with her. She loved playing the pokies and wanted days out, so I would take her out and do that. But, you know, sometimes, I took her to Fiji and places like that too. She was a feminist way before it was ever popular to do so. Also a lesbian, you know, way before, you know, that was, you know, acceptable in any terms. And she started going to the gym when she was 65. Did that until into her 90s too, and developed these biceps that you would really be jealous. I was jealous of them. And so she, just a very close friend. And the thing is, I took from her, like, all the things that she faced in her life, all the prejudice, all the hardships on all these levels, like class, obviously gender, all the homophobia, and, you know, just how tough she was. And, so I took a lot of inspiration from her.
What an extraordinary woman, and a beautiful note, I guess, to finish on. I could go on talking to you for ages, Sally, but unfortunately we will have to leave it there. But a beautiful memory of Margaret Jones. Thanks so much for giving us the time that you have, and I know your schedule is incredibly busy, so I really appreciate the time. It's been fascinating, really fascinating. And thank you to all of you who've stayed with us. Don't forget, you can jump on to broadtalk.net, send us an email at hello@broadtalk.net, and keep the conversation going, and join us again for the next in this series. It's been fun, and we're learning so much about these incredible Australian women change makers. So until next time, don't forget, keep talking.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.